Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
The opening barrage was terrific. You could see trees and things, they all looked out. Like a photo flash. You could see the whole scene for just for a moment under 1,000 flashes. It was highly spectacular, and then gradually it spaced out. At first, it was 1,000 guns, bang, all together, and then they were firing in their own time. So it was just a continuous thing, but it was quite impressive. I remember there was a nightingale singing in the tree just above my tent. The other subalterns came along and said, "Wyke, it's 2:15, we've brought a bottle." And we sat there on the grass listening to this nightingale singing away, and then when the barrage came up, it stopped. But about 5 minutes after it started, the nightingales began to sing again against the din. You could hear them quite distinctly, 2 or 3 of them singing away against this incredible cacophony. Extraordinary. A concerto of nightingales and cannons. And that was Lieutenant Ted Wyke Smith, the 281st Field Company, Field Park Company, Royal Engineers, 78th Division.
Well, you did that absolutely beautifully. Absolutely beautifully. And Ted sounded just like that, I've got to say.
Oh, great. Oh, that's a relief.
He was an absolutely splendid fellow. Had a moustache then, had a moustache when he died.
Oh, and, marvellous.
You can picture him. He was thin.
But that's quite something. I mean, the nightingales and the...
It's just such a brilliant description. I just remember him telling me that. We were sat in some hotel front room drinking coffee somewhere in South Devon. I remember it very, very well. But so in this episode, that is describing the opening barrage of 1,600 artillery pieces that launched the beginning of Operation Diadem, which is the Allies' final big effort to kind of break through to Rome, which begins on the evening of the 11th of May, 1944. And what we're going to do in this episode is
get to
look at the background of those plans. We're going to get there. Well, maybe get a little bit beyond as well. We're going to have a look at a little bit of the situation again in Italy, because I think it's very important that we don't come over all too military and that we remember that this is a population of 40 million people in Italy who are sort of suffering while this typhoon of steel is sweeping its way. This sort of twister is sort of working its way up the leg of Italy. And then we'll look at what the plans are and all the rest of it. I mean, I think the thing to sort of keep in one's mind is that Anzio is a big operation, really, in the big scheme of things, or suddenly becomes a very big operation. The battles at Cassino variously are quite big operations, but this is an entirely different beast. I mean, this is on a gargantuan scale, and it is really the culmination of the invasion that begins in September 1943. This is what sees the fourth of those four aims, three of which are got by the end of September, which we talked about in the first episode in this series, but this is the last one. Capturing Rome, and this is what this episode is all about, really.
And given how things have gone since September, I mean, that, you know, we're allowed to do this with history, we can jump ahead a little. The fact that Rome is essentially captured intact, given how things have gone since September, is remarkable, really.
Well, yes, absolutely.
And there is a swirl of criticism and counter-criticism and legend and whatever around the capture of Rome. But the fact that Rome isn't pummeled in the way that up till now the rest of Italy has been, is not, I think, nothing short of miraculous, actually. And so for all the criticism about the pace of operations and the decisions made and the you know, the people making those decisions and all that Rome, like Paris, and there's a peculiar sort of duality there, isn't there? That both of these historic capital cities and political prizes are both taken essentially without the Allies having to flatten them, which is, of course, the other way, which is what they've been doing so far. You know, up to this point, flattening has been the order of the day.
Well, we were talking about Cassino in the last episode and the flattening of the city. I mean, there's a sort of, you know, I know the city was already bashed about and all the rest of it and it was empty and a ghost town and so on and had been kind of substantially kind of reworked by the labyrinth of defences that the German engineers had built. But there's something kind of very unsettling, I think, about deliberately raising from the face of the earth entirely an entire Italian town in that way. And I was sort of thinking about it afterwards. I don't think up until that point there is a greater concentration of ordnance anywhere in the war, not even in the Soviet Union, than there is on Cassino. You know, you're talking about 890 guns. You're talking about 1,000 tons of bombs. you think of all that firepower all being pummeled into an area about a kind of, you know, mile by a mile and a half. It's and obviously some of it goes astray, but I mean that's a, can you think of a concentration of fire that equals that anywhere in the war up until up to March 1944? I can't think of one. Not in the Soviet Union, because it's always spread out so much, isn't it? It's huge, but it's spread out more. But in such a small space of time, I mean, this is a kind of a raw demonstration of the huge technical power of the Allies, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, even Citadel, that because of the spacing, you've got an unprecedented amount of assets crammed into the Kursk salient, and I'm glad we've got ourselves a salient already in this episode, nice and early. Even with that, like you say, because of the, you know, the terrain and the way everything's spread out, you know, it's the magnetic attraction of Cassino, isn't it? To soldiers that after all, Francis is one of the things Francis Tucker conceptually warns about is getting hung up on pieces of territory when you should be keeping the battle moving. So I mean, it's sort of little wonder. It's the only. I mean, you're heading up the Italian peninsula in that direction. There's no avoiding, isn't it? So you probably are going to bring everything you can to bear on it. I mean, the sort of inevitability of it all. I think I know nothing's inevitable, and that's the thing we try and remind of ourselves.
I agree with that, and of course, one of the problems with even the battle in March. I mean, let's not forget that the reason that it takes till the 15th of March, you know, the infantry waiting to attack have been waiting in that area for the best part of 3 weeks, waiting to go. And that's because it's been pouring with rain. And that means your axes of advance are very, very small. And even if you did get through it, they would be very small beyond that as well because of the waterlogged ground and all the rest of it. And this is the constant frustration of the Allies in Italy from the 1st of October until the middle of April, pretty much, or the beginning of April. 1944, they can't do what they want to do because the weather precludes it. You know, the ground is waterlogged, it's just raining all the time, and they can't bring their preponderance of fire. You know, this is not North Africa anymore, and all these ideas about how you fight have all been worked out in the kind of, you know, the dryness, the arid nature of the North African desert and beyond, and even to, you know, on Sicily, of course, as well. So fighting in winter is something that they've just never done before. And they haven't been prepared for that. So what they're able to do after Cassino, which becomes the third Cassino, fails to fully break through, is they go, right, okay, we've already agreed that this is just a kind of an extra anyway. Our main effort has got to be to pause, to rotate, to take people out of the line, stop this frenetic pace, which is doing no one any favours. It's making the generals tetchy. It's not achieving the results we want. Morale is taking a massive dip. All the men are exhausted. Let's just pause. Let's wait for the better weather. Wait until we can use our air assets to their full advantage. Wait till we can use our tanks and our armour and our track vehicles and trucks and everything to our full advantage. And then let's go for it. And that is unquestionably the right decision. But I think before we get onto Diadem, I think it's important to probably just have another quick look at what's going on in the situation in Italy. I mean, it's kind of no change really from that kind of brief kind of overview that we gave of the RSI, the Socialist Republic under Mussolini, and sort of overseen by Obergruppenführer Karl Wolff. But in the south, there is some change. 75% of all food and goods to Italian civilians is now being handled within the black market. And the guy who is now completely running the roost in all of Naples area and beyond is Vito Genovese. And Vito Genovese was Lucky Luciano's right-hand man who left New York just before the war on a murder charge, moved back to Italy, and then when the Allies came into Sicily, inveigled his way into the team of Charles Poletti, who became the Allied military governor in Palermo. And Poletti, although there's absolutely nothing that would ever stick on him, was a former governor general of New York, obviously is Italian, obviously knew Lucky Luciano, and obviously knew Vito Genovese beforehand. And the idea that there wasn't a, you know, it was like, oh, another Italian, you're here, you speak Italian, how convenient. Maybe you could help me. The idea that they hadn't already made connections beforehand is frankly ridiculous, although there's no hard, fast proof about it. So I could be slandering.
Jim, you don't want a visit from the Soprano family if you carry on like this.
No, right? You absolutely anyway. Don't. You effing F. No, you absolutely don't. But anyway, so guess who is now in charge of AMG of Naples? It's Charles Poletti. And guess who is now running the roost and absolutely king of the black market? And the reason he's king of the black market is because of the vast amounts of penicillin he is. he has half-inched. And he is the Mafia King. He is the godfather of the black market, and he's a very, very bad man.
I understand you have an infection and would like something to help with that infection.
You want a cure. You know, of course you want a cure. I can help you with that.
I got you two cures. One, you do me a favor, I give you the penicillin. The other favor is we say night-night.
Yeah, all that kind of schmuck. Anyway, all that stuff's going on. And it's making everyone's lives very, very wretched. It has to be said. Now, the other thing is worth saying about in the North is that it is now springtime, more and more partisans. And this is largely in response to the call-up orders, both for the SS police battalions, the GNR, and also because of these four divisions that Mussolini's been allowed to organise in his to raise in his new model army. And so people have run to the hills and all the rest of it. There is also kind of increased politicisation in the North. So the CLN, which is the Committee of National Liberation, they've also got a structure based in Milan, and that's a CLNAI, which is Alta Italia, which is Northern Italy, so the CLN of Northern Italy. And they are trying to help foment these partisan bands. Now, a lot of them are Garibaldi brigades, and Garibaldi brigades are basically communist-based, and they're largely made up of people who used to fight for the Republicans in the Spanish Civil War. Not exclusively, but a large number of them are. And there's also partisans, of course, operating in Rome. There's three particular groups, but the largest one is the GAPIS, which is the Partisan Action Group, I suppose is what you would call it. And the GAPIS are they're the biggest one, and they've been doing lots and lots of operations in and around the Rome area, and really, really escalated things from the end of 1943 onwards, from turning on kind of fascists to actually turning on Germans. And the biggest thing they undertake is the bomb attack on the Via Casilina, which is an SS police battalion marching through the Via Casilina. The Via Casilina is right in the heart of Rome, but it's one of those sort of back streets off a main street. So it runs parallel to a main street. It's got high buildings either side. It's quite narrow. And what they do is they pretend to be dustbin men, and they're sort of keeping watch, and they plant a bomb in the dustbin. And as the police battalion are going past, it detonates. And 33 of these police battalion are killed. And it's quite interesting because if you go to the Via Rosella now, you can still see the shrapnel marks all over the blast marks all over the buildings. It's really very, very cool. But anyway, it has really awful long term far-reaching consequences, because Hitler goes absolutely batshit crazy when he hears about this. He's not having that, and he demands, you know, 200 for every one that's been killed. Then that gets reduced to kind of 50, and then Kesselring settles on 10. So consults with sort of Jodl and Keitel and says, look, you know, we really can't do 50, but we'll do 10, and that can now be the rule and the benchmark from now on, that any German soldier who gets killed by Italian civilians or partisans or whatever, there will be 10 who have to pay for their lives. It is Herbert Kappler, who is the head of the SD, Gestapo, in Rome, and it's his job to find these 333 people that are going to be executed in recompense for revenge for the 33 that are killed in this SS police battalion. And so he thinks, well, that's not a problem. We'll just go to the prisons and get all the people that are kind of on death row, and we'll get them out and all the rest of it. But they just, you know, that amounts to about 16. And then they're scrabbling around. They go, well, you know, there are any Jews left in Rome. We'll get them. They're scrabbling around. They just can't find a way. So they start getting kind of petty criminals and all sorts of stuff. Anyway, the following day, they've managed, you know, a kind of sort of absolutely, they're totally stressed out by this, trying to find these people that they can execute. I mean, it's so grotesque. It's absolutely revolting. They put them all into trucks, get them out of these prisons, put them all into trucks, and they take them down to the Argentina Caves, which is on the Via Argentina, just outside of, just to the south of Rome. So you go through the those huge great Roman walls south of the city, and you move on. And very quickly in Rome, it turns into quite a small country lane, really. It is still the Via Argentina, but it's quite a small road. And then as you're heading southwards on the left-hand side of these caves, and these really old natural quarries. Well, they're probably not natural. But anyway, these caves there. And they take them all in, you know, bit by bit. And they shoot them all in the back of the head. And then they suddenly realize there's two extras, there's 335. And they think, well, they can't just sort of take them back because they've now seen it all. So they have to kill them as well. And these are all kind of, you know, in groups of 10, kneel, bang, 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 shot in the back of the neck and left there. And this is going on. So, I mean, you know, it's pretty bad if you're the first 10 or first five. But it's freaking miserable if you're the last 50 or whatever. And one of the other people of this is Eric Priebke, who is Kappler's number two, who's also doing all this, and a whole load of troops. And they're all absolutely, they're drunk. They're shit-faced because it's so horrible. And then, having finally executed all 335 in this cave, they leave the bodies there and cover them all with lime. So they all kind of rot very quickly and disintegrate. God. And it is absolutely appalling. And that all takes place on exactly the same day that the Third Battle of Cassino is called off, 23rd of March. Well, no, 23rd of March is the Via Rosella, and 24th of March, the very next day, is the day of this massacre. But unfortunately, without wanting to do too much of a spoiler, and we should do, at some point later on, we should do, maybe next year, we could do the rest of the Italian campaign as a series, but you know, and look into some detail at the partisan operations. But this sets a terrible bar. And of course, it's kind of sort of violence begets violence and all this kind of stuff. And it really sets a terrible standard. And there are hundreds of civilian massacres that take place between now and May 1945.
Well, I go back to what I said the other day about in France, that France, again, and obviously there are reprisals and there are atrocities in France, but that France to some extent gets off lightly in this regard, doesn't it? That yes, you do have Ordre Ségolène, but this is much more like an East, you know, I mean, nothing is like the scale of slaughter on the Eastern Front, civilian slaughter and murder. And partisan murder on the, you know, because after all, that's caught up in the genocide that the Germans are practicing in on the Eastern Front. But this is a much more intense and higher level of reprisal and death and murder than you have in France. And it comes around to, you know, Italy's misfortune in having 2 years of or two and a half years of land war happen in it. You know, isn't it? That's what comes with it. The government, these, you know, what would a Vichy government have done, pressure cooked, had the war in France lasted longer? You know what I mean? Although the Vichy by the time of the invasion, of course, has essentially been completely pushed out of the pitch. But you know what? There is this peculiar feeling that, you know, France, for all of its misfortune, did well out the deal when it comes
to it's interesting.
Its occupation and then subsequent Allied liberation. You know,
Italy was absolutely horrendous.
Yeah, it's diabolical, and I think, but that's the standard to measure it by.
Yeah, maybe we should do a little series on the Partisan War. You know, it's so interesting. There's so many twists and turns and stuff. And I always felt that, you know, when I did that book, Italy Sorry, all those years ago, that, you know, I was finding out some quite sort of revelatory stuff which no one ever picked up on, because you suddenly realize you're the only person in the world that knows this stuff, apart from kind of some sort of, you know, remote local historian in Italy or something. And it's just, so it doesn't seem very, very sort of significant, but it is really, really interesting and how it all developed and how it came about. And actually the people that chose to fight on the other side.
But Jim, just as you were saying earlier on, that, you know, the concentration of firepower at Cassino is probably the first kind of stuff of that scale of the Second World War. And obviously, like, you know, the following year, you do get massive concentrations, bomber concentrations particularly, used tactically and all that sort of stuff. You know, Kohl receives the same treatment, doesn't it? And that so much of what's happening in Italy, the idea that Italy's a sideshow, this is where the Allies are figuring out all over again how to fight in temperate Europe. And also, you're seeing the effects it has on an occupied country that's, you know, tried to ride both tigers, as it were. I mean, it's the idea that it gets put to one side in the history of the Second World War, or regarded as a sideshow and all that sort of thing. It's not a sideshow if you're Italian. Jesus Christ.
No, it certainly isn't. It certainly isn't. Anyway, meanwhile, in the South, it's quite interesting because they are mentioning, you know, since they've got the, you may remember that before it was just Allied military government. Then there is a buffer, which is Allied military government, which is, you know, just sort of 20 miles or so south of the front. Then there is the Allied Control Commission, which is overseeing the Italian government going about their business. So it is better than the kind of, you know, the RSI equivalent of with German overseeing. You know, the Allies are trying to hand back power to the Italians. And the sticking point has been the king, the future of the king, because the CLN, these democratic parties, won't serve under the king. And then eventually, at the persuasion of people like Macmillan, Harold Macmillan, who is, you know, the High Commissioner for Britain in Italy and on the Allied Control Commission, and frankly, the leading diplomat over there, and Robert Murphy, who is his American equivalent, they persuade the CLN to kind of do some concessions, particularly the communists. And the communists agree that they will enter an all-party government without mentioning the king. And this then allows the other less radical political parties to kind of go, okay, well, if the commies are doing it, then we should toe the line as well. And at the same time, 2 days later, on the 10th of April, Macmillan and Robert Murphy go to see the king and say, you have to abdicate. The time has come. And he says, I'm not going to abdicate my title, but I will abdicate my powers to my son. So that happens. And that is both the political parties and the monarchy both sort of giving an inch, but not much more. But basically,
But it being enough.
Well, what the king has done is he's opened the door, and it's only a job, but it's going to be blown wide open, and he is absolutely toast. So that is the end of him. But and although Badoglio, Marshal Badoglio, stays on as prime minister, Count Sforza and Togliatti do agree, who's the commie guy, do agree to kind of be ministers. And that is, although they haven't been voted for, it is about as democratic a government as you're going to get in the circumstances in Italy now. And that is such a leap forward from 1922 and the beginning of fascism. Now, the other big thing that's going on while everyone's getting ready for Diadem is Operation Strangle. And Wilson is very, very keen on this. And people may remember that Jumbo Wilson is the Supreme Allied Commander in the Mediterranean. And he's very keen on trying to use air power, as are Ira Aker and John Slessor, who are the commander of and deputy commander of Allied Air Forces in the Mediterranean. And this is basically interdiction. This is the transport plan. This is arguments about...
It's the appliance of science, Jim. It's Solly Zuckerman. I mean...
Solly Zuckerman, your old friend.
Well, friend of the show, Solly Zuckerman, who, the bombing expert, who becomes a bombing expert by virtue of being the only person looking into the effects of bombing during the Blitz. He ends up... I mean, he says this himself. He says, just because I was the only person doing the research, the next thing I know, I'm the world expert on it. No one else is the guru. And he's such a fascinating man. But Pantelleria is where they let him prove his theory. They let him loose. And the idea is that you apply air power, and the air power does all the work, and that fixes. You don't need to send any troops in. It's still not flesh, it's sort of, but red in tooth and claw. So it's the idea is that because I think one of the interesting things about steel not flesh is it sounds like no one's getting killed. But actually what steel not flesh means is the other side are getting killed, not your side. So there's, you know...
Not our flesh.
Exactly.
Our flesh. Yeah.
Their flesh.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
And Zuckerman, you know, there's nothing bloodless about steel not flesh. I think that's one of the interesting things about getting your head around it as an idea, because steel not flesh is dropping the atom bomb, you know, in the end. It's about applying your technological edge to persuade the enemy of the folly of his ways, and you do it anyway. If you do that by gumming up the railways, which is what the plan is here, that's what you do. Because they've been striking bridges, haven't they?
They've been largely striking bridges, and Zuckerman says that's a waste of time. You don't want to be doing that. You want to be just hitting marshalling yards. And there's something like 48 marshalling yards in Germany, and over 100 100 stations that have tracks of more than 10 filtering into the stations. So these are all very good ones. And the local people on the ground, and this is 12th Air Force. So you've got 15 Air Forces, a strategic Air Force, or heavy bombers operating out of Foggia, and you've got the 12th Air Force, which is the tactical ground support Air Force. And these are the ones that would do, this is a bit like, you know, 2nd TAF and the 9th US 9th Air Force before Normandy. These are the guys who are coming in, medium bombers, Mitchells and Bostons and Marauders, coming in at low level, fighter bombers, shooting up bridges and stuff. And what 12th Air Force says is, yeah, it's great to do marshalling yards, but you're completely wrong to say hitting bridges is a waste of time. It absolutely isn't. And of course, they're quite right. You know, the answer is, let's do a bit of both. So they send off the heavies to do the marshalling yards, and they do basically the 12th Air Force do most of the bridges. And Operation Strangle doesn't achieve what it's hoped to achieve, which is completely dislocate the German ability to reinforce the front. But it still has a huge effect. And part one is the 19th to the 31st of March. And then part two is the 1st of April to the 11th of May. And by the 4th of April, I think this statistic is really, really amazing. So by the 4th of April, Kesselring is reporting that he's receiving only 1,357 tons daily instead of 2,261 that he was getting. Now, just compare that with the 4,000 tons a day, which the Allies are pumping into Anzio. I mean, it's just amazing. And by the end of April, the central route is cut in 69 places. So there's basically three rail routes that go down the down Italy. One is the coastal one, Pisa, Livorno, Rome, and then the main one, the absolute biggest main line of all, is Florence, Arezzo, Orvieto, Rome, and that cuts winds its way through the Apennines, and then the other one is Rimini, Ancona. The Adriatic one obviously isn't as important. The two big ones are the Pisa, you know, is the Tyrrhenian coast one, and the west. And then that central one going down through kind of, you know, so it goes down through the Brenner Pass to Bolzano, Verona, Bologna, Florence, Arezzo, Orvieto, and then it's Rome. And these are absolutely vital. And these are cut. But what is amazing about the Germans, and you cannot help but be awed by their logistical prowess, because, you know, whether that be kind of getting troops in the bridgehead from 800 to 22,000 on day one of Shingle, the invasion of Anzio, or whether it's maintaining these railway lines. So what they do is the railway, the trains come to the stop, then they unload everything, get it to the next waiting train, who takes it onto the next cut, They unload it again, put them on to the next. I mean, I cannot understand how they do this. But of course, one of the reasons they are able to do this is because they haven't got lots of trucks and vehicles and they haven't got lots of fuel to pass through. It's basically ammunition and small arms and artillery pieces and mortars and machine guns and manpower, all of which is quite movable. So what this will be doing is stopping any kind of offensive operation whatsoever.
Yeah.
What it won't be doing is preventing them from manning a foxhole or an MG post or a mortar pit.
Yeah, but it's a colossal embuggerance. I mean, the thing is
colossal.
I mean, you know, in your notes you say it fails in aim, but not a failure. If you weren't doing this, imagine what the Germans would be able to do. Like any bombing campaign, what would the enemy be able to do if you weren't doing this to him? And how does that, you know, literally a cost benefit analysis on that? This is if he's short on his daily tonnage, it's a complete pain in the ass. And yes, ammunition needs to come forward, but the enemy's also having to put a load of effort into this. Rather than his engineers are tied up in this, his logisticians are tied up in this. They're not tied up in the business of preparing for the defense, the next phase of whatever the Allies are going to deliver to him. So they're preoccupied with this problem. And I think that strikes me as perfectly sensible. It's amazing there would even be an argument about it, really.
Yes, it's just that the aim is to completely stop them totally from, you know, totally stop that, and it doesn't achieve that. But under no so by that, by those parameters, it's a failure. By any other parameters, it's a rip-roaring success. And what it's starting to show is that air power clearly has an incredibly important and decisive role in future ground battles, but it can't do all your work for you.
No.
And that's the conclusion. And of course, all this is absolute, it's just the most fantastic proving ground for what's going to go on in Northwest Europe. Which is another very good reason for keeping going with the Italian campaign.
With which, actually, by the time you're looking at 1st April to the 11th of May, the second phase, they're overlapping anyway. The whole thing's overlapping anyway. There's a continuum here rather than lots of separate things going on all at once. There's a grand continuum.
Well, let's take a quick break there. And then when we come back, we'll be looking at the plan for Diadem and how the first stages of the battle get underway. See you in a minute.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to We Have Ways of Making You Talk, where James and I in episode 402 of this series about the race for Rome. Operation Diadem, Jim, then. So this is Alex's two-army plan. So this is a two-army punch. This isn't piecemeal divisional attempts to get across rivers. This is a two armies side by side. 8th Army down the Liri Valley, 5th Army down the southern side of the Liri Valley. So this is a great big thing.
Yeah, and I guess actually it's probably even more than that. It's probably like a three-army thing because the 6th Corps in Anzio is so huge now. You know, by any reckoning, that's an army. It's certainly bigger than Sixth Corps in Anzio is bigger than any army that the Germans have got in terms of boots on the ground. So it's effectively a three-army punch. And this is suddenly kind of, you know, it's spring. It's the beginning of May. Summer's on its way. The ground's dried out. It's the blue skies overhead. It's the azure blue and twinkly Mediterranean that we know and love of Italy, rather than the kind of sort of miserable winter. And this is the Allies bringing their scale and might and steel and not your flesh to bear. I mean, that is what this is all about. But it's the idea is this, that 8th Army will burst through into the Liri Valley. And because the Liri Valley is easier to get through than mountains, they will take the lead and they will push on down the Liri Valley using the Via Casilina, Highway 6, as their main axis of advance. Meanwhile, on their flank, the CEF, the French Corps, and US 2 Corps we'll be advancing through the Urumqi Mountains and along the Turanian coast. And because they'll be behind, what will happen at a certain point, the German 10th Army will be forced back down the Via Casilina to escape north, because all roads lead to Rome, so you've got to go to Rome to get north again. And then at a certain point, 6th Corps will then break out of the Anzio bridgehead and cut straight across the valley between the Alban Hills and the Lepini Mountains. The Urumqi Mountains run into the Lepini Mountains, and cut Highway 6, the Via Casilina, at a small little town perched overlooking the Via Casilina called Valmontoni, thereby encircling the large bulk of AOK 10, the German 10th Army, in a massive giant pocket.
Yeah.
That's the plan.
Yes. Well, of course, no plan survives contact
with the enemy.
With me, all the weather in Italy. So, but this is 1,600 guns, 1,000 behind 8th Army, 600 behind 5th Army. And then the barrage that we had at the start with
the Nightingales and cannons.
Ted Wyke-Smith with Nightingales begins at 11 p.m. on Thursday, the 11th of May. So, and this is the battle for Rome, isn't it? No two ways about it.
This is a battle for Rome, yeah. That's the battle for Rome. And it can't fail. It has to happen. And also, it has to happen before D-Day.
It's too big to fail. It's got to happen before D-Day, yeah.
It was going to start in the middle of April. That was the original plan for it. But for all sorts of reasons, the time getting, you know, reorganizing the armies, getting them untangled, getting them trained, getting things in place, blah, blah, blah. It's not until the 11th of May that it happens. But Alexander reckons it's going to take 3 weeks, which is, you know, D-Day starts on, you know, 5th of June, then happy days. That's the idea.
Yes. So how do 8th Army get on?
Well, they do, you know, they do okay, because, they, you know, the big thing for the 8th Army is you would think that the French and the Americans of two corps, and in two corps there's two brand new divisions new to the front. There's the 88th and the 85th Infantry Divisions. And you'd think they wouldn't do so well. But they don't have any rivers to cross, because they're already on the other side, the western side of the Garigliano, created by 10 Corps back in January. So they're already there. They've crossed. So that's job done. And the troops there are the 71st Infantry Division and the 94th Infantry Division, who are absolutely smashed from months of fighting. And okay, so they've had some replacement troops, but as you know, replacement troops into German divisions is not what we would call replacement troops into kind of British or New Zealand or Canadian or American divisions or French divisions for that matter.
Yeah. And they're caught in a chaotic supply situation too, logistics situation.
They're caught in a chaotic supply situation in a very big way. And obviously, when you're in mountains, you're holding mountain positions, it's much harder to maintain those lines than it is if you've got the main axis of advance north or south at your back, which is what the 14th Panzer Corps and the bulk of 10th Army have got in the Liri Valley, etc., and around Cassino. So that's the other thing. And the other thing about the 71st and 74th is that you may remember from one of the first episodes, I think it was the second episode, I was saying there is a, right next to Minterno on the south coast, there is a kind of triangular kind of hill block. And then there's a valley, which is where the river Assente runs through, called the Assente Valley, which leads up to Ausonia. And then there's another mountain mass, which is the Urumqi Mountains with Monte Damiano and all the rest of it. But what that means is, If the French and the Americans can get along the Turanian coast and clear that triangular hill mass, then they've got a kind of clear run down the coast, the Americans have. And if the French can get into the Ausente Valley, they've got a clear run into the Ausente Valley, which ultimately leads halfway up the Liri Valley. So actually, they've got the easier job. And the problem that the problem that 8th Army have got is that they've got to get across the River Rapido, the same Rapido that the Texans had to get across back in January, exactly the same spot around Sant'Angelo in Firdice. And they've then got to get across the River Liri, and then they've got to get across the Melfa, and they've got to get across the Piapetta and various other things. And the whole Liri Valley is riven with little water features and courses and things that need bridging, which is why Ted Wyke-Smith ends up doing 26 bridges in 28 nights. And they've got to get something like 9 bridges over to get the bulk of the armor across, because the whole point this time is now it's dry on the ground. You can get your armor in, but you can only get your armor in if you can get across the rivers. So you've got to bridge them first.
But the rivers are—they're not in flood the way they were in the winter attempts to cross. So
no. They're much lower and all that. But they're still a massive great ditch, you know, with water running through them.
So 840, you got the Bailey Bridge, Oxford across the Rapido, which is a class 40. By 10 a.m., there's a class 30 bridge, Plymouth. I mean, the sappers here are working their asses off, aren't they?
Yeah, and they're getting absolutely hammered. because you're concentrated where as soon as the Germans know where the bridges are, down come all the mortars, and you're trying to put this bloody bridge across while you're being hammered. And, you know, you keep taking cover every 2 minutes. Then, you know, Bert gets killed, and then suddenly Fred's got taken out and lost a leg or been blasted by shrapnel or whatever. You know, so you're being attrited while you're doing it.
Well, and the more men you have, the quicker you can get the Bailey Bridge up. You know, it's designed to... It's designed
but also the more men you have, the more casualties you have.
Well, exactly, but it's designed as a 2-4 man, you know, like the all the weights are key to how many people you've got, and the speed you can assemble it is key to how many people you've got. And if they, like you say, if the guys are getting cut, if there are more people, there's more casualties, but you need more people, so there will be more casualties. Unfortunately, this is a flesh and steel problem, erecting Bailey Bridges in a hurry.
Meanwhile.
Well, yes, the meanwhile, yes. So
the Poles are up on Monte Cassino.
Yeah.
Which General Anders considers a great honour, and General Oliver Lees gives this to them, and he paints it as this kind of, you know, I know this is a huge amount to ask your men, but you know, think of the glory if the Poles can take Monte Cassino. And, you know, Anders's chest kind of swells a little bit with pride, and he takes a deep breath and goes, you know, no, my men are equal to this challenge, you know, thinking of revenge for Poland and all the rest of it. The only reason Lees asks us this, because he doesn't want any confusion with the Poles who don't speak English. He wants to go, okay, park them in something where they can be completely isolated, do their own thing, tie it off, and that's why they're up there. And the problem is no one... Part of the battle plan is deception, even though, you know, it's pretty bloody obvious what's going on. And for some bizarre reason, they don't want the Germans to know that it's the Poles opposite them, which means they go up there kind of silently and you know, aren't allowed to do active patrol work.
Oh, God.
Why?
Oh, God.
You know, do you think that's going to make a massive difference to the Fallschirmjäger who's dug into his figure of eight circle? Oh, no, it's not the New Zealanders anymore. It's not the Indians anymore. Now it's the Poles. Oh, well, whatever.
But what's the German response? They're caught off guard by all this, right, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah, completely.
There's a load of people away, aren't there? Von Fietinghoff's away. Von Senger's away.
Yes, he's at an indoctrination course.
Yeah. Oberst von Altenstadt is away. He's chief of staff.
He's chief of staff, yeah.
Generalmajor Bader is away. Kesselring's chief of staff, General Westphal. I mean, so... Maybe some of the deceptions worked. Does it? You know, all these.
It is, yeah. And Von Senger's temporary substitute is brand new to Italy, and he's been given, you know, he's been given the job of 14th Panzer Corps at the heart, you know, at the strongest point. I mean, what the hell are they thinking? I mean, it is absolutely insane, and it is amazing how often this happens. I mean, Alamein starts. The Second Battle of Alamein starts when Rommel's away. It happens time and time again, and so. The long short of it is that the only senior commander that is still here is Furstein, who is the 51st Mountain Corps commander on the kind of flank of on the left hand flank, kind of eastward flank of 14th Panzer Corps, and Kesselring himself. So Kesselring ends up conducting the battle, and as we know, tactically, he's very, very, very good operationally. Tactically, Kesselring is very, very suspect.
Yeah, he's not good at picking his battles at all.
Yeah. No, and there's nothing he likes more than kind of sending penny packets left, right, and centre to fire brigade stuff. And the other thing is that the other Allied air power we were talking about, Strangle, has been incredibly effective. But what they now do is they now smother the battlefront and the battle area, and particularly just behind the battlefront, hammering all the army headquarters. So Army Group C, which is Monte Serrate, which is where Kesselring is as well, you know, that's plastered by 185 tons. 10th Army's headquarters at Avezzano, that's also... hammered, and the operations branch is destroyed, and the advanced headquarters has to move to Frosinone. 1st Fallschirmjäger headquarters, 44th Division headquarters, 15th Panzer Grenadier Division headquarters, they are all very, very badly smashed up, and there is huge, huge, huge dislocation. But the problem is, again, is this issue of, that's great, and it's fantastic and huge help, but you still got to get over these rivers.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is the thing that, because that's clearly the fruits of some good SIGINT and some good, you know, listening and Y service stuff and some ultra. It's obviously the fruit of all that. But in the end, if you're one of these benighted sappers carrying a portion of Bailey Bridge, being mortared by Nebelwerfers and, you know, MG42s on fixed lines and all that sort of stuff. Well, great, whoopee-doo, they bombed the headquarters of 1st Fallschirmjäger. It makes no difference to me right now. Because you know, sometimes I think confusing that aspect of Allied prowess with things going well Because it's like, you know, it's not like these Falchim Jaeger need telling what to do either, is it? You could blow up their headquarters. It's not really like they need telling what to do at this stage of things, is it? They don't need their orders. Like you say, they're in a figure of eight. They're dug in. They know their fields of fire. The first glimmer of khaki they get, off they go. I mean, it's, or they wait until they've got them all nicely lined up in a row. I mean, it's because they have fire discipline. They know what they're doing. So more bridges. Amazon Bridge on the 13th of May at 5:30 a.m. is open, but it's cost 67 sappers.
Yeah, that's a lot. That's a lot of sappers.
It's a lot of people, yeah. Two bridges on the 12th of May, one bridge on the 30th. Six bridges on the 14th of May.
Yeah, so by then the nine are up, you know. So that's six bridges for 8th Indian Division, who are the kind of lead division, and three bridges for the 4th Infantry Division. But the problem, of course, what happens with this is it's just absolutely enormous bottlenecks. I mean, you can just...
Inevitably, imagine, yeah.
Inevitably, because you suddenly you're like, yeah, we got all these vehicles, great. We got all this armor. We're going to push it through. But it doesn't take much to kind of hold the whole thing up. You know, a tank gets knocked over on the road, then someone's got to come along and move out of the way. And then the bridging party's got to come up and everyone's got to move out of the way. It's just stop, start, stop, start, stop, start, stop, start the whole time. And they can't make very, very, very good headway. Meanwhile, the French are doing great. And US 2 Corps, the Spigno-Saturnia Ridge, which is that triangular ridge just kind of inland from Minterno, that's taken by the Americans on the 14th of May. And on that same day, the French burst into the Orsente Valley, something that has proved completely elusive to 10 Corps back in January and early February. They just couldn't quite get the Germans entirely off the ridge, just couldn't quite get into that valley. And now they can. And that is, and the other thing about it is that the German 71st and 94th Division are completely separated now. So the 94th Division is retreating down the Tyrrhenian coast, while the 94th is disappearing into the mountains and far end of the Ascenti Valley. So they've come separated. So that is a massive, massive problem for the Germans. And what it means is that the CEF, the French, and US 2 Corps are ahead, not behind 8th Army. That's a big thing.
That's a really big thing.
And I haven't really told you about what the Poles do. So the Poles attack just after midnight on the morning of the 12th of May. And they do attack down the two ridges, and they do get 593, but lo and behold, they get pushed back again. It's the same old lessons. And they take a pretty big hit, you know, sort of 1,300 casualties or something in the first day. And you know, they can't do it. And again, it's because they don't understand the figure of eight. They don't understand the defensive system of the Germans. And the Germans are just lying in wait. You know, they're there still with their machine guns, with their mortars, and their wire and mines. And you know, the problems of attacking that position haven't changed at all.
But this could easily be a byproduct of not patrolling, because after all, you know, you patrol, you capture someone, you bring them back, and you pump them for info. So that is definitely an error, isn't it?
Yeah, huge. Yeah,
or a very strange decision. And also, you know, you find out where they all are. I mean, the Poles have skin in the game, though, don't they, in a different way to other people, perhaps, in this theatre, right? They very much want to get their hands on the Germans, don't they?
They very much want revenge.
Yeah. Yeah, they really, really do want, they do want to get at them. So, and is he taking this as a tremendous honour still while it's going like this, or is he?
Yeah, no, he is. He's absolutely mortified that they haven't broken through. But, you know, it's been a tough nut. And you know, so they basically retreat, they fall back, hold their lines, lick their wounds, and go, right, okay, well, at least they now know where we are and who we are, so let's do some active patrol work. So they do some very, very active patrol work, and this finally reveals to them what the system is. It is the Poles in this patrol work, after the failed first attempt, that work out that it's this figure of eight, that 0.593 is the apex of the figure of eight, and that you need to overwhelm more than 50% of both sides of the circle, both circles, to shut it down. So while this is going on, they're preparing for the next attack, and it's going to be a much bigger attack. It's going to be on a two-divisional front.
Right.
And they're going to smother it.
And they're going to completely smother it. Hmm. So you can't, they figured you can't chip away at this piecemeal the way it's been done up till now.
You can't send companies down ridges.
No.
No sirree.
You have to overwhelm them. Overwhelm
them. And you have to be prepared to take the hits.
Yeah.
If you're going to do it this route.
So Alex has 3 weeks, or given himself 3 weeks, hasn't he, basically. We start on the 11th of May. On the 16th of May, he says, the battle is progressing steadily forward. We can now claim that we've definitively broken the Gustav line. But it is certain that we shall have to stage a full-scale offensive against the Adolf Hitler line, which will be held to the last by all the German elements available. Before this attack can be developed, it will necessitate moving our artillery forward.
In other words, so what he means by that is this is the next phase, getting the Adolf Hitler line, which has been renamed the Senger line, because a line that has the Führer's name to it, can't be defeated. And this basically comes out. So if you've got the Gustav Line sort of, you know, going in one direction, basically it's coming out like a
spur.
If the Gustav Line is kind of sort of pointing at 9 o'clock, this is coming at kind of sort of between 10 and 11. So it's coming out, yes, like a spur, like a sort of, you know, like a spoke from a wheel, and cutting across the Liri Valley at an angle. And basically what Alexander is saying is, we've got through the Gustav Line. Now we need to kind of pack everything up, move everything forward, start again, prepared, proper thing with a barrage, another attack, proper organized attack. And that ain't going to happen overnight. So basically by this stage, they've had a week of, you know, best part of a week of a battle by the time that the offensive is renewed again. And they haven't really got very far. Not 8th Army, but 5th Army is going great. Great guns.
Stuff bubbling on
that is, and that is starting to change everything about the dynamics of the battle and what happens in the second half of this absolutely incredible battle. I mean, it is full of twists and turns and controversies and excitements, but ultimately, spoiler alert, ends in Allied triumph. But anyway, we'll be looking at that in our next, and I dare say, final episode in this series.
Well, thanks everyone for listening. Join us for episode 785 of The Race for Rome. If you want to listen to this without adverts or in one great big dollop, you can join our Apple channel on Apple Podcasts, or become a patron and subscribe to our Patreon, where there's other stuff going on too. And even better, if you want to actually directly inject this war waffle straight into your eyes and ears, then come to We Have Ways Fest the 19th to the 21st of July at Blackpit Brewery, right next door to Silverstone, just off the M40. Go to wehavewaysfest.co.uk for your tickets, where all your favourite contributors, James and myself, aircraft, tanks, living historians, people dug mysteriously into woods, smoking 1940s cigarettes for authenticity purposes. Everything you could ever possibly hope for, plus quantities of ale to wash down all these newly learned facts and opinions. At We Have Ways Fest in the summer. Please join us. We'd love to see you. It was tons of fun last time, and we've just announced the speaker lineup recently, and it's shaping up into the best festival we've done yet. So we look forward to seeing you there. And kids are welcome. I think kids under 16 are free, if I remember rightly. Come free, I can't remember. But check it out and come and see us. And in our next episode, we will get to Rome. And as we said earlier on, Rome essentially is delivered unscathed into the Allied hands, which for my money, given everything that's going on in Italy, is a miracle. And one that we should all thank Harold Alexander for. Isn't that right, Jim?
Yeah, 100%. He's the hero.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
Arrivederci.